Would you like to see Barack Obama removed from the White House? Would you like to have a president that's been faithful and married to the same woman for over 50 years? Would you like to have a president that will veto funding for Planned Parenthood, facilities that perform abortion, and for family planning schemes? Would you like to have a president that will restore America? At this time, I'd like to bring forward two people that today are endorsing Congressman Paul, the Story County Republican Chairman, my friend Corey Adams, and Representative Jason Schultz. Please come forward. At this time, I'll introduce you to Corey Adams, the Chairman of the Story County Republicans. I serve on the Story County Central Committee with Corey, go to church with Corey at St. Cecilia Catholic Church here in Ames, and I'm proud to call him a friend. So, Corey Adams.
Thank you, AJ. I am Corey Adams. I am the chairman of the Story County Republican Party. I've always had a very deep interest in American history, especially the Revolution. Sharing the surname with two of its brightest stars definitely helped kickstart that interest. So as I looked at political candidates, I tried to find the ones that best line up with the ideals and the concepts and the principles of our founders. I see in the Republican field that we have this cycle a lot of those candidates, but there's only one that has the extensive and the consistent voting record to back up those principles, and that is why I am proud today to endorse Ron Paul for president.
Thank you, Corey. And Representative Jason Schultz.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. My name is Jason Schultz. I'm a state representative from House District 55 in West Central Iowa. We face perilous times in these United States. Over the past generation, the established political class has led our federal government to debase our currency, to betray our free market principles, and to trade capitalism for government corporatism. And most importantly, they have lost the trust and the faith of the American people. This is why I am proudly endorsing Congressman Ron Paul, and I'm excited to see him become our next president of the United States. I am attracted to Congressman Ron Paul due to his courage, his consistency, and his credibility. Ron Paul's moral underpinnings, his sense of right and wrong, have led him within the constitutional framework to guide us to vote to try to return us back to the constitutional republic of which we began. His statesmanship, his positive attitude, he does not take pot shots at people, and he always stays on the high ground. He is a gentleman and a statesman. And his electability. Our recent polls show that head-to-head, our Congressman Ron Paul, not this district's, but our Ron Paul, in a head-to-head matchup is virtually within the margin of error. The American people have found that there is a man who speaks the truth, who has a 30-year record of consistent voting in their best interests. And ladies and gentlemen, in a time when elected officials seem to represent the government down to us, Congressman Ron Paul represents the people to the government, and I believe that's what was meant to be. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce, please come forward, Congressman Ron Paul.
Thank you very much. AJ, thank you, and Corey, and Jason, thank you for the endorsement, and thank you all for coming out. It was an early start for me, but it was still an early start for you to get up and come over in the middle of summer and listen to politicians, you know. But you know, when I come to groups like this, I see a group like this as being rather unique, because sometimes we who are involved in politics all the time and talk to people like you, we get the idea that every single person out there is really interested and know what's going on. But you know, it isn't quite the case. Most people wait till the last minute and they make their decisions. So people who are active are rather unique, and they're driven not by superficial comments and superficial views, but because they believe in something, they're willing to work and donate to candidates. So a group like this is, to me, very, very important. It's especially important on the circumstances of what's going to come up here on August 13, because I keep thinking, you know, an individual vote, voting in the Ames straw vote, when you think of it nationally, I mean, it, in comparison, since you get so much attention and can make or break some people in campaigning, it's worth a lot more than 100 individuals voting. It could be thousands of votes for somebody to show up and vote and make a difference in a race. And that is why I am here, and that's why I think Iowa is important. That's why I think the Ames straw vote is important. And it's also good because it gives an opportunity for everybody to have a chance. You know, a lot of rich people run for office, and a lot of people have many millions of dollars, but it always and a lot of them do real well. You've heard of them running for senator and running for governor, and the money is and has been very important. But every once in a while, these very, very rich people, independently wealthy, might spend $50, $60, $100 million on their own and then lose. It sort of gives me a little boost thinking, you know, the people, you know, money just doesn't buy everything. So ideas and issues and hard work is so important. I think the Ames straw vote is particularly introduces this idea and makes it much more democratic in the good sense of the word, that we can all compete. So I thank you for coming out, and I know a lot of you are supporters, and some have come to listen and find out more about me, and I appreciate that. What I would like to do is summarize pretty much what I believe in and what I've been doing and what my goals are, at the same time then leaving time for questions, because you may have very sincere questions, and hopefully I can answer those. At the same time, I learn a lot from the question too, because if I talk a bit about the economy and nobody cares about the economy and nobody asks about it and every question is on something else, then I'll learn something. But right now, I happen to think the economy is a pretty important subject, and it's hard to avoid thinking about it because there's so much uncertainty. You cannot even avoid thinking about the way the economy is going. And hardly can anybody avoid thinking about raising the debt limit. I mean, this has been incessant. So very briefly, I want to touch on the debt limit and the debate going on. That the way I see this, there's a lot of artificial stuff going on about August 2nd, the end of our whole country and the whole world is going to happen if we don't raise the debt limit, if there's a so-called default. But quite a few times in our history, our country unfortunately has defaulted when they promised to pay in gold, and they broke that promise several times. Even not too long ago, 1978, we had a dollar crisis, and we couldn't support the dollar. And this was a form of bankruptcy. It wasn't the kind of bankruptcy where you couldn't raise the debt limit, but internationally, nobody wanted our dollars. And guess who bailed us out? The IMF. We went hat in hand to the IMF and got like $30 billion, which today would be like $300 billion to prop up the dollar. So this is not brand new, but it's an important debate because this whole issue is demonstrating that the country is bankrupt. And nobody wants to hear that because it sounds overwhelming, because bankruptcy is bad news. If you're an individual, you have to do a lot of things. You have to cut back on spending. Sometimes you have to get another job. Sometimes you have to declare bankruptcy. But your standard of living changes. And if you're able, many people will say, no, I'm going to pay my debt off. And they cut way back on spending. And they work much harder and work their way out of it. Others will just go into bankruptcy and default and not pay the debt. But when a country gets so indebted like we are today, countries usually default. Small countries that are less significant than a major country like ours, they default by not paying bills, and they wipe the bill, you know, in South America and different places, even in some of our states in the 19th century, just defaulted and wrote the debt off the books. But what countries most likely do, if they're larger, is they default by just printing money. And that is a default, because if the government owes you $10,000 in a treasury bill or in a bond, and after 10 years is up, they give you your $10,000, but what if the $10,000 buys about 25 cents on the dollar? Somebody stole 75% of your money. And that's a default. That is what's going to happen in this country. There is no way we're not going to write the checks. There is no way that's going to happen. There's no way that the checks aren't going out for Social Security. But the real concern has to be, what is the money going to buy when you get it? You know, there was one proposal in the Senate. I think this came from what they called the Gang of Six. And one of the proposals in it, it was tax increases and spending cuts, and it was sort of middle of the road, moderate approach. But what they put in here is what you have to be concerned about. And that was, they changed once again how you calculate the CPI, how you calculate the cost of living increases. So what they did was they said, well, we're going to change it, and then it'll make it look like the cost of living isn't going up. Now, even today, the CPI is measured differently than it did 15 years ago. But if you use the old measurement, prices are going up 10%. If you use the new measurement that the government tells you, it's going up 2%. And they're going to change it again, but that's to keep from giving the elderly any cost of living increase. And yet, how many people does that fool? Now, if I come in here and say to you, well, you know, if you worry too much, there's no problems. Your cost of living is going up. The value of your dollar is good as gold, so don't worry about it. How many of you would believe that? Probably, hopefully not too many, because it wouldn't be true. So this is an issue that I have thought about and dealt with. Matter of fact, it motivated me in 1970s to run for Congress, because when we lost our last link to gold, which restrains government, I knew at that time that we would embark on big government spending. And look at any economic chart from 1971 up to now. It has been a parabolic move up on spending and deficits and size of government, number of bureaucrats, on and on. This was predictable because there was no restraint on the printing press. And governments and politicians were able to vote for whatever they thought the people needed. And they also embarked on spending anything that was needed around the world. We got into wars that we shouldn't have been involved in, and foreign aid, the whole works. And if you didn't have that Federal Reserve there that would print the money as the Congress needed it, what would happen is interest rates would go up. And people say, well, that's terrible. That'll slow down the economy. Yes, but it would have brought it to your attention that there was something wrong, and we would have stopped it. But instead, we allowed this system to develop where we could just print the money and keep interest rates artificially low. And the natural consequence for this are bubbles. NASDAQ bubble, HouseDex bubble, now housing bubble. Now we have a bond bubble. The price, the value of a bond is too high, makes interest rates too low. That is a consequence of the Federal Reserve. So this is a reason from the very first day I ran for office, I talked about monetary policy in relationship to the size and scope of government and your liberty. And we are at a climactic point right now. This is not going to go away. This is not a small recession. You cannot solve this problem if you don't understand how we got into the problem, and you have to understand the business cycle. That is why I take a very strong stand on the Federal Reserve. I believe the Federal Reserve ought to be audited and then phased out completely. While we're at it, we can think about 1913. It was a bad year. You know, that 13, we have to, and yet, you know, I'm hoping that August 13 is going to be a very good number. but 1913 wasn't a good year, because that's when Wilson ushered in the Federal Reserve, also the income tax, and also a change in the foreign policy. Because I think Woodrow Wilson was the first neocon, because he felt like this obligation, you know, to spread our goodness around the world and sacrifice our young people and sacrifice all this money and get us involved that has just led to a disastrous 20th century, and it continues now with the neocon wars constantly. Most Americans, and even I, have to stop and think, how many wars are we actually in right now? Yeah. That's tragic. You know, I'm pretty old-fashioned in that sense. Old-fashioned that I believe in the Constitution, and we should never go to war without a declaration of war. That's what we should do. A president has an obligation to defend this country under attack. That's a little bit different than constantly fighting wars or going to war like in Libya. That is a war. Just because it's in combination with NATO and the United Nations and we're bombing from the air, it's still a war. But in this war, the president didn't even come to the Congress. You know, sometimes it's not a declaration, but it's a token effort to get the funding for the war. But if we'd have stuck to our guns, how the founders indicated, this was a big issue for the founders. They did not like what the king did, use the resources and go to war and tax them for war. So they wanted the power to be put into the hands of the people in the Congress. But if we do this cautiously, and we know that we have an enemy, such as we had in World War II, the people come together. There's a declaration of war. You know who the enemy is, and you know when the war's over. And that's the way it should be. Just think, in World War II, it was less than 4 years of hard fighting. And the Germans and the Japanese were defeated. And here we've been in Afghanistan for more than 10 years. Because we haven't even figured out exactly who the enemy is. And now we're in Libya and Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan and Iraq. Iraq is not a settled place, believe me. It is not a settled place. One thing I came across just recently that won't please you, I'm sure, because it doesn't please me, you know, the tens of thousands of Iraqis who get special privileges to come to our country because they were on our side in the war, but now that we're moving out, they're afraid for their life. So it is not a safe place. More than half of the Christians have had to leave Iraq. Saddam Hussein was a monster, but compared to what? I mean, it is such a mess over there. So what we are doing is not accomplishing much at all, other than bankrupting our countries. Countries go bankrupt when they spread themselves around the world too much, and we have done that. The Soviet system in recent history came down, and ironically, they came down for extending themselves into where? Afghanistan. So this is why I take a very strong constitutional, non-interventionist foreign policy advised by the founders, and that is, in order to really help salvage what's happening here at home and taking care of our people home, I say, bring our troops home and stop these wars because we just don't need them anymore. It's one thing a president can do. It's an undeclared war. He could bring the troops home and you don't have to fire anybody to get some economic benefit. Just think of these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops would just come home and spend their money at home. I mean, the Germans like us to be in Germany. And the Koreans like us to be in South Korea because we spend the money as well as Japan. We spend a lot of money there. So that money would have been immediately be spent back here. And then, of course, the foreign policy has to be changed. But a president has this authority to move the troops around, and that could be done. And I think it would send a very strong message that we're just not going to continue to fight these no-win wars forever and ever. But the one thing that over and above the economy and sound money that I think about, because I think it's the most important issue, and that's your liberty. This is what the government should exist for. This is why we had a revolution. This is why we have a special emphasis with our 10 amendments to the Constitution. This is why we have Article 1, Section 8, and especially 9th and 10th Amendment. It was to protect liberty. The Constitution is written very clearly not to restrain you. And today, we're being restrained by our government endlessly, and our property is being interfered with. It's a violation of contracts. They're the counterfeiters of the world. So the Constitution, though, is very clearly written. Go back and look at it. It's to restrain the government, the federal government. Local government would have more leeway, but it was not meant to have the government telling us everything that we have to do and what we can't do. And this is the reason why I think many things should go back to the states and let the states take care of things. But liberty, to me, is the goal. If and we have a chance of this happening, we'll lose even more wealth because we owe $3 trillion to foreigners right now. This is a big problem. But let's say it is recognized, but if the money fails and there's economic chaos, the only thing we need is our freedom. The freedom to act, the freedom to work, the freedom to keep what we have, and get the government out our way, off our backs. I think in a year or so, we'd all be back on our feet because the American people would work hard, and knowing the incentives would come back again. So it's liberty that is the key to it. But to understand liberty, we have to understand where it comes from. It doesn't come from our government. It comes from our Creator. We get our rights to our life and our liberty from our Creator, and therefore government. Government should be there to protect liberty, never to interfere with it. We unfortunately have drifted to the point of thinking that if we sacrifice a little bit of liberty, we'll have economic security and personal security. I don't believe in that. I don't believe for your economic security and your personal security depends on sacrificing anything. We want to protect your liberties, and I think we would be much better off. This, to me, is so important, but understanding the importance of individual liberty also indicates to me that if the purpose of government is to protect life, therefore we should protect all life. All life should be protected by government, and therefore that is the reason I'm a strong right-to-life person, because if you can't protect all life, how can you protect all liberty? How can we protect homeschooling and personal choices and your religious value if you haven't had a strong stand on protecting all life? This is the big picture that comes together, and that we were introduced to this. I'm afraid we're losing it, but we can restate it and build on it. We want a society that emphasizes liberty. That means you have free markets, you have sound money, you have contracts that are enforceable, and you have protection of personal liberty. You don't put up with what we put up as a people at the airports. We've had enough of that, and they don't make us safer, and we have to include in that a non-intervention foreign policy where we treat people differently. You know, right now we have a foreign policy that if they agree with us, we give them money. If they disagree with them, we drop bombs on them. And I say, let's have another alternative. Let's neither give them money nor drop bombs on them. Do what the founder said, trade with them, talk with them, and try to be friends with everybody. That is, I believe, the way we can reach both peace and prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Paul. We did have a few members of the press that requested to ask a question today. Marlo with Fox News.
She's not here, but I work with her.
Oh, okay. Yes, you sure can.
Congressman, you've gotten a reputation and a well-earned one as one who does really well with straw polls. Could you enlighten us as to how it is that you've been able to do that and how you plan to use that experience in trying to channel that into success Saturday of August?
Yes, he asked a question about how do we do so well in straw votes, and we've done quite well. I think it's the enthusiasm of the supporters, because they know what they believe in and what we stand for, and they're willing to go the extra mile. And it's for that reason, because the message is spreading so much further. I mean, it hasn't been like there was a campaign 4 years ago and then it was suspended and we're trying to stir it up again. There's been steady growth in these views. The economic crisis came, and the foreign wars are getting to be a burden. So the enthusiasm is growing. There's more enthusiasm with the people who are true believers. And like I said in my opening statement, Ames lends itself to that. So I wished I could say that I am the front runner and nobody's ahead of me and it's a shoe-in. But the truth is that we can do it and will do very, very well and hopefully come in first. But I tell you what, I'll challenge any other candidate for the enthusiasm of our supporters.
Yeah, thank you for the straw poll question. I want to remind everybody in the room, Steve Bierfeld and the campaign staff do have discounted straw poll tickets, $10. It includes busing to Ames, great activities at the Ron Paul 2012 tent on the straw poll grounds. We also have t-shirts, a lot of fun things going on. So see those guys afterwards out in the hallway. They will get you signed up, taken care of, and help you get to the straw poll. Our next question today is from the Ames Tribune, Bob Zantara.
Congressman, assuming you take the oath of office in January of 2013, you won't have a Congress of both houses that has people of the same philosophy as yourself. How do you propose to work with people of opposing points of view to implement your program?
You know, I think it's a good question because it lends itself to understanding what I'm all about. Because if you look at what I've done over the years, I've probably been able to work with coalitions better than anybody else. And you don't have to sacrifice any principle, whether you're from the left or the right, if you can find some other people that agree with you on these issues. So you take the issue of transparency of the Federal Reserve. This was passed in the House of Representatives. All Republicans supported it, and a large number of Democrats supported it. So you bring people together. Same way on the foreign policy. It's getting more popular every single day with all Americans to bring troops home. Yet traditionally that was supposed to be more, you know, the Obama position. You know, he was going to end those wars and bring everybody home, and now they're disenchanted. So I think a candidate like myself and a president like myself would bring people together. And this is what has to be done. And on the spending issues, I think that the same thing can happen too. Let those who are on the left, let them pick and choose where to cut. And those on the right, let them pick and choose. And then say, well, that's the compromise. Instead of, over the years, over these decades, it's always the left wants to spend here, the right wants to spend over here. They get together and agree, okay, let's keep spending. And that's how we got into this mess. So I'm going to get this new coalition where we get together and everybody gets to pick on what they want to cut.
Shannon with CNN had a question.
Congressman Paul, what do you think of, I mean, the straw poll is shaping up to be, a lot of people are focusing on Congresswoman Bachman as well as Governor Pawlenty. They're back and forth. What do you think of the exchange between Republican and Republican, the harsh exchange?
The exchange between the
two of them.
I haven't followed it that closely, but since I'm not engaged and I don't think it's going to have any downside for me, I'm probably not going to get involved in whatever is going on. But I do know one thing: when you see that, or even add up all the rest, since their positions are different than mine and they're arguing over the detailed differences that they have, maybe style more than substance, I see that that doesn't hurt. It really helps our campaign. Because our campaign is quite different. They're not saying, bring the troops home. They're not saying, let's really look into this TSA and change this thing. Let's look into the personal liberty. Let's deal with the Federal Reserve. And there is quite a bit of difference. So you will have those differences. But I see the other candidates all in one group who do not come out and explicitly say what we must do and what the nature of our problem actually is.
Josh with the Des Moines Register.
Campaign recently released a statement saying that you guys received more donations from stated military members than any other campaign. You've also said that we need a foreign policy that isn't built on militarism. So what about your foreign policy do you think resonates so much with U.S. military members?
The foreign policy in relation to what?
What about your foreign policy do you think resonates so much with voters in the military?
Oh, great question.
As of the moment, since I'm the only candidate that's been in the military, maybe that helps me identify with all of it. I was in the Air Force for 5 years, and I kid that I was a volunteer, but the story is I got a draft notice when I was a second year resident, and this was during the Cuban crisis, that I would be drafted as a buck private and put in the Army. And I said, they said, but if you volunteer, we'll give you, you can be a captain and you can practice medicine. I said, I'm a volunteer. So no, the identification with the military is, I think, fantastic. But I think back into the times, I got off active duty in 65. And 65 was the year we escalated in Vietnam. But I was still in the reserves. I was in the Air National Guard. And the last thing I wanted to do was have a president that wanted to expand the war. I mean, it was dreadful. And don't you think, I bet you somebody knows somebody here that's been in the reserves, the Air National Guard, and even on active duty, that may have been there once or twice or three times, and not see an end to this. So this is the reason I think the military support me. It happened in the last campaign. It was more than double what all the other candidates got from active military duty, and it was more than the president got from active military duty in this last quarter. So I think it's a very powerful message, and the subtleness of that question has been in the past that, you know, if you don't vote to spend the money and send the troops around the world, that you're against the troops, and that you're un-American, you're unpatriotic. Well, maybe you're patriotic if you live up to the Constitution, only go to war when you declare the war. So I am very pleased with that record of getting this funding, and I think it's going to accelerate because the problems are going to accelerate and the need for a new foreign policy is going to be very clear.
Thank you, Congressman Paul. Great answer. I know as a son of a Vietnam veteran, my father raised me that you don't go to war without a declaration of war. And that was something that was very important to him because he saw the politics that took place in the 1960s between the Democrats and the Republicans, pulling troops here and there, foreigners that could shoot at us and we couldn't shoot back during ceasefires. So. Next question is from Kay Henderson, Radio Iowa.
Congressman Paul, you said the debt ceiling debate is artificial. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the rating agencies, which are not part of the government, and their participation in the debate now about government debt.
Right. On whether or not the debate is artificial and what about the bond rating agencies. All you have to do is look at the history of the bond rating agencies that in the past 10 years before NASDAQ or especially the housing bubble burst, the agencies were saying Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were perfectly okay. They have no credibility whatsoever. And I think even though they're not technically part of the government, I think they're very much involved in politics and the threat and innuendos that we're going to raise your debt limit unless you have, lower your rating unless you raise the debt limit. So I think August 2nd is artificial, but I think it's so misleading because, and I said earlier on, we have this debt, we can't pay it, it will be liquidated. The argument is only over whether it's deflation or inflation, and therefore they're misleading you, and they're particularly pushing on these dates, and that's what I think is important. But I wouldn't place a whole lot. I wouldn't say that we have to do it because of the Moody's or whoever's going to do the bond rating. That to me is a subtle threat.
Did you have a follow-up?
I don't know whether I think it is misleading. Whether they sit down and connive to do this and they work on it, but they have no credibility. You know, if they couldn't tell us that there was a housing bubble, how can they tell us there's a crisis, you know, coming? Matter of fact, if this. In order to emphasize this whole debate going on, let's say that we could wave a wand and we don't have that law that says there should be a debt limit. So we don't have to debate that. You know, there are some people who are actually thinking about this. Give the power to the president, just spend the money he has to, and the Congress spends. So let's say that tomorrow we do that, and the president can raise the debt limit anytime he wants. I think it would devastate the markets. Because to me, my reaction would be, wow, you think they're printing money now? Where do you see it now? There'll be no restraints. I think it would devastate the markets, and yet they're arguing that if you don't raise the debt limit, you're going to devastate the markets. You know, they think that would be just horrible. So, yeah, I think it's misleading. I don't know the details of who does what or how they work with each other, but I don't think it's very objective, these bond rating agencies.
And we have time for three questions from the crowd.
go ahead. Okay, mine was first. I was going to ask yesterday, I was talking to a relative to ask what he thought of you, and he said his response was that he thought you were an isolationist. Well, you've kind of explained that here, I got that, I mean, and about your foreign policy. And just so I can forward to him, what writings would I be able to, we would be able to get of yours, or where to point me in the direction to give him so that he could understand more why that is not a bad thing, maybe, or to explain it more?
Am I allowed to do that by promoting a book? The Revolution, the book Revolution, there's a very good chapter. Yeah, it has a chapter in there. But also Liberty Defined has another chapter in that. And the question is about isolationism versus non-interventionism. And isolationism is more of a populist position where you have a lot of tariffs and protectionism, and you sort of close in. Where a free market approach is, you know, you want people and ideas and goods and services to go across borders. We like the idea that we actually can buy and sell, even though the trade is all messed up, with all countries, because we're less likely to fight with them. We were killing each other when I was in high school with the Chinese, but in spite of the shortcomings of what's going on now, it's a blessing compared to killing each other. Same way with Vietnam. We have a much freer trade with Vietnam. And of course, they warned if Vietnam fell, there'd be the domino effect, and all become communist. But now we go back and forth and trade, even with their imperfections and our imperfections. So I think trade is fantastic. And those individuals who keep using that word, he's an isolationist. What they fail to see is those people who are saying this happen to be people who love the UN and WTO and international government who manages trade. I don't like that. I want real free trade. But they're also the ones who fight free trade and are always wanting to put sanctions on other countries. I happen to think that Castro's not much of a threat anymore. So I would say, why is everybody else trading with Castro? Why can't we trade with Castro? I think if we'd have been trading with Castro the last 25 years, Castro would have faded, because all his problems were blamed on America. So those individuals who shout isolationism are much more protectionist than I am.
Gentleman back here in the red.
Bring peace to the entire world and dividend to this country, our country. peace activist. I've been having a hard time to explain to my friend that Ron Paul is the best hope that the entire world have for the peace, knowing your position of non-interventionist. How could you help me to explain myself better to my pro-peace activist friend that you are that person? How about that book I was talking about?
Well, no, he asked a challenging question because he asked how he essentially agreed with me. This is good for the world. And you know, interestingly enough, I get a lot of letters from around the world. Matter of fact, in the last campaign, we actually had meetup groups around the world, which was really strange and baffling to me, but it was nice. But it is, it's a peace. How can you, if you can argue the case for peace and not give up any of your liberties and it helps your economy, how can anybody be opposed to it? And now I think it's just a matter of people like you and others that get convinced that it's the right thing to do. I defend it from the Constitution. I defend it from economics. I defend it from a moral basis and just a practical basis. So I'm sure it can be frustrating. I think one of the frustrations is today that people had placed a lot of hope in Obama because can you imagine now he gets in and he was the peace candidate. George Bush was the peace candidate in the year 2000. He wanted a humble foreign policy and no nation building. So here Obama comes along and he's the peace candidate. He's in office 1 month and he wins the Nobel Prize for Peace. And then he goes out and starts five wars. So there's a lot of people disenchanted about that. And I think what helps me is the fact that, you know, I haven't done any of that, what do they call that, flip-flopping and that sort of thing. And they know I've been saying this for a long time. So I think we will only be helping this when we have more people understanding it, knowing that it is truly an American position. It's a good world position for bringing about peace. And we don't use aggression to do it. You know, we don't initiate force. I like to think of the foreign policy as being something like an international golden rule. When people say, well, we have to do this, they might come and hit us, and so we have to kill them all right now. I said, always think about what we do is, what if another country is stronger than us, which they may be someday, what if they did it to us? You know, how would we feel if somebody lobbed a cruise missile on us and then, oh, well, we want to hit that guy, but we killed 100 innocent people. We wouldn't like it one bit. There would be no two-party, three-party system in this country. We'd all be united, and we'd all be convinced the Second Amendment is a good amendment.
Yeah. Lady in the white.
I have a bill in Congress called the We the People's Act, and just by majority vote, you could take the jurisdiction away from the Supreme Court. So if you had laws in Iowa different than what they want in Massachusetts, you could pass those and you could maintain your state sovereignty. That doesn't mean that you will do everything perfectly, but it also means that if somebody, another state, does things badly, it doesn't bother you. So I think that is the best approach, to take away the jurisdiction. And you would not have to have a Supreme Court, wait for the Supreme Court to be changed or change the Constitution. I'm not against doing that and working over time, but this could be done by a majority vote in Congress. I was disappointed it didn't happen when we had the House and the Senate and the presidency. There was no move to move that legislation along. Actually, I take one step further. I don't think we'll see the day for what I consider more ideal. And you stated the position that's more practical, that we're going to have these discussions, we are going to have some rules, we're going to have some definition. But you know, ideally for me, I would just as soon see less government involvement. I always think the church should be involved, and that's where you get married. And quite frankly, I get so tired of this definition of who's going to define what. And I just don't want to argue. To me, it's sort of like religion. You know, I have the perfect religion. You have the perfect religion. We, most of the time, we understand this, and we let everybody declare it. So if people have perfect rules about social behavior, as long as they don't have the people, I want the government to be out of it. So I would just as soon see the states control it like they are now, or even work to the point where, why do we have to get a license to get married? You know, when I got married, my wife and I got married, what they say, 54, you said, right? 54 years ago. I don't, why do we have to get a license to do this? So that would be my idealistic approach, but in the meantime, it is what you stated, I'd have the states doing it, taking care of it.
And I do want to remind everybody that we have discounted straw poll tickets, so make sure you see Steve on your way out and get your discounted straw poll ticket. At this time, we're going to form kind of a reception line with Congressman Paul over by the north door. If you want to form a line there, Congressman Paul is going to stay up front. He has a couple pictures to take, but if you'd like to shake the congressman's hand or get a photo with him, please head towards that door. There are two other doors here. If you're not going to stay to shake his hand, please use those doors.
One final challenge on AIDS. You know something? We're not here for entertainment. We're not here for intellectual discussions. We're here to impact on this country, the future of this country. And you do that by action, not by sitting and talking and discussing and blogging and talking some more, but by action. Your action on August 13th will do something. The rest of this won't necessarily, but that will do something. Take your citizenship seriously. Participate and get your friends there also. Thank you. And then the Instagram.